Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. Thank you for joining us today for this special Thanksgiving week series where we're talking about leadership transition in the nonprofit sector. Before I introduce my guest, I want to share what's happening here at Responsive Fundraising. In January, we will be introducing not one, not two, not three. We will be introducing four new members of Responsive's consulting practice. Whereas I will continue to serve a select few clients, my time will become more focused on strengthening the brand, identifying new opportunities and developing the Responsive theory. These individuals will take the lead with Responsive's growing national network of clients. As you will soon discover, we believe these four individuals have exactly what it takes to take our practice to a whole new level. Each of these individuals believes in the vision of Responsive fundraising. They have a desire to redefine what it means to partner with charitable organizations, and they want to be a part of creating organizations where fundraising can thrive. We're not quite ready to let the cat out of the bag as to who these four individuals are. However, I can assure you that no one is more eager and excited than me to introduce you to all of our new team members. Hi, Liz. Thank you for being a returning guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I had a conversation, I don't know, it's probably been a year now, and we just had an opportunity to sort of catch up. We're having a conversation about leadership transition in the nonprofit sector today. We've been doing this all week, and you're helping us sort of wrap up this conversation. We've had lots of great ideas and opinions about leadership transition. But before we talk about that, Liz, why don't you just briefly introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Well, Jason, thank you for inviting me back. It's a real honor, and I'm really glad to be here. So I'm at Franciscan University in a little town called Steubenville, Ohio. It's on the Ohio River, right between Pennsylvania and Ohio. It's a Catholic university. And my position is currently director. I hold a couple of positions actually at the university, but specific to fundraising, I am the director of market engagement and special gifts.
So a number of people have sort of commented and offered some opinions about leadership transition in the nonprofit sector this week, Liz. What's your sort of take on that, and sort of like a really big macro level?
Big macro level. Okay, so from a big macro level, and obviously, Jason, I'm going to speak to this through not just the nonprofit lens, but also through the lens of a faith-based organization,
right? Yep.
And being a faith-based woman,
yep,
right?
That's so, fine.
So from a macro level, I feel a calling in my life to leadership. So all throughout my whole career, I've done leadership. And even when I was raising my children and homeschooled my children in a very intentional manner, and really believe that God called me to do that as a leadership action. So when I joined this nonprofit I've actually been in the nonprofit world for many, many years, and I had a stint of about 10 years in the for-profit world. So in the nonprofit world in leadership, I think that the position sometimes is less relevant than the posture. And what I mean by that is the posture of heart and head. And so I see myself as a servant leader. And when I've stepped into a role with any organization, and in this case, nonprofit, then I've always taken the posture of leadership, and that manifests itself, for example, at Franciscan University. there was a need for, I was asked to be part of a new program for mentors for students. And so I saw that as a classic example of a call in my life to lead other women. And so I stepped into that role. It doesn't come with a title or anything like that. It just comes with doing that work. I saw a need for a professional development program for women at Franciscan. And so I worked with a couple of other women. We collaborated and we have launched and developed and are continuing to run a program to do that. Again, no title, just a need. And I responded to it from my posture of leading. So that's the summary.
So we've heard a lot of opinions this week about, how do we, so the big question that I have sort of asked at the beginning of this conversation is this idea of honoring. I think and everyone seems to appreciate the word honoring. But there also tends to be a preference for sort of using a different word rather than retirement. So, I really appreciated one of our guests used the word graduation. So how do we honor sort of the graduating, generation of leaders, that have presumably led a lot of our organizations, say for the last 10, 20, 30, you know, multiple decades in a lot of cases. How do we honor that generation of people?
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. You mean as they're retiring and then you're stepping into those roles?
Yeah. So as transition is happening. Yeah, sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, so as transitioning is happening, we've got this generation that's leaving. It was one of our guests earlier this week who suggested that retirement just doesn't seem like, especially with, like, when we think about the baby boomers, for example, most of them are in perfectly good health. They could easily work for multiple decades more if they wanted to. But to suggest that they're going to quote unquote retire, isn't necessarily the best definition of what it is they're going to do next. And so as they're doing whatever they're going to do, one of our guests suggested they're graduating, used the word graduating, which I thought was an interesting use of the term. How do we honor them in that process?
Yeah. So I think, I guess the way that I could respond to that, and I'm not sure if it's totally going to answer your question, but I have a woman I work with, we're actually friends, but we began working on a book called Design Your Life. And we worked on that book about a year ago. And when we first started working on the book, she was looking at retirement down the road. But for her, for a variety of different reasons, you know, work was a big part of her life. If she looked at the horizon, say, the horizon looked very bare. She knew that she was going to be too physically, you know, very physically capable, and that she needed to have stuff in her next stage of her life. But it looked bare. She didn't know what to put in there. And so we started to work on kind of unpacking that and really building that horizon, that landscape, so it had things in it. And, you know, it's funny because she was kind of halfway through it and she said, I think I have to retire tomorrow because I don't think I've got enough time in my life to actually do all the things I want to do in retirement. So that was her posture. But I think that in working with her, one of the things that I've noticed with her has been she was really holding on to her position. Like when she retired, she wanted to make sure she'd left a legacy and that nobody messed with it, you know, and that it, you know, that she had come up with those great ideas and she really wanted it to be part of the next generation, if you will, in that position. It was career counseling. And so she looked at that and then she said, to watch her journey, she's got to a point now where she's just like let go of that. It's like, you know what? I did the very best I could do in the time I was in this position. And now it's up to the next person to come in and do whatever they want, whatever they think is best for the upcoming generations of students, et cetera. And I was just really struck by what the gifts that she's going to give her, the next person that steps into that role. And I wonder if, so in answering your question, I feel like really, and I know this is going to be controversial when I say this, and I don't mean it to be harsh, I don't mean it to be controversial, but really, should we be? Like, I do think we honour people because of the people and they've done work, but yeah. is that really what's important here? Or what's important is that at that moment of retirement, it's a celebration for all parts. It's a celebration of that person moving on to their next chapter.
Yeah.
And are looking forward, not back, you know? And it's a celebration of the people stepping into that position that they are really going to be fabulous stewards of, you know, of young people who right now are 16 years of age and are about to enter college in the next 2 or 3 years. And honestly, I'm 53 years of age, right? So I'm kind of in that interesting kind of middle place. And I really look at young people and I think to myself, you know, I might know a 16-year-old and have a bit of a handle on that because I have children that are a little bit older than that, but still that age group. But anybody who's like 10 right now and is going to come to university in 8 more years, I'm not so sure I'm going to know that the brain of that person, you know, or the heart of that person. And so I'm hoping that there'll be younger people. And in fact, I just brought on my first alum. I'll wrap it up with this. But I brought on my first alum into our development department, a young woman. And I'm so excited to bring her on because her insight into her generation is invaluable to me. So my job is to really groom her so that, you know, that she'll be better than me is my where my heart's at, you know. So anyway, that's it.
Okay. I really like where you just went with that. So let's carry that a little further. I'm of the opinion, and I haven't heard a lot of people this week articulate it this way, but I'm of the opinion, speaking for myself, that the younger generation, we'll call them they certainly get referred to as the millennials, but I think they're, I think there's this younger generation of young people that are coming into the workplace that I think are creating unnecessary pressure on the workplace to sort of advance the whole process.
Right.
I think the young person is coming in and saying, I'm very well educated. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to take on the world. And consequently, they're sort of pushing the process and expediting the process of where people are in their careers. And consequently, whoever's at the top is either got to advance, and if there's nowhere else for them to go, they've got to get out. Does that make sense? And what's your thoughts on that? Because I don't know if I kind of feel like if we're not honoring, but we're sort of celebrating where we are in life. I almost want to tell the 26-year-old, hey, why don't you just enjoy this for like 10 years? Because trust me, when you're 36, you're not going to want the job that they're going to finally have given you. You know,
But I think that wisdom comes with age, right? And you know, if you think back to who we were, nobody could tell me anything when I was 22 years of age, right?
So,
so I feel like part of that comes from, again, a posture of fear. And, you know, I'm a very confident woman, and I'm also very confident in my God, and that even when things don't go my way, that's entirely maybe the best thing in my life, you know. Like, at 49, I had a heart attack, for example, and it's like, that's not what I would write into the script of my life, but it was, but it's been a blessing. It's, you know, in hindsight, it's been a really great thing to happen in my life. So I guess if we weren't looking at, as leaders, if we weren't looking at this from a posture of fear, and we were looking at this as, you know, I'm at a chapter in my life and as a leader where what I know young people do want is, A, they have a false bravado and overconfidence often in their own abilities. B, they have an impatience for opportunity. But C, they are individual people. And so, and they're looking for development. So what I've done is I've worked with lots of young people, and not just young people, but people who have also started businesses in a for-profit world as well. And I've used a coaching style and a leadership style that is coaching. So, you know, I personally value, and I would, if I was 22, I would value within the first 3 months of a new position, my boss sitting down with me and saying, so where do you want to be in the next 3 to 5 years and how can I help you get there? And so, again, that posture, that kind of questioning, that kind of asking those and coaching that way, yeah, and taking the time for it is counter to a posture of fear. Like, you know, I really want this new person we've brought on to our department to one day be better than me. Now, I know that she's not going to be better than me tomorrow, right? Other than some things. I mean, there's some things that she does that I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not touching that. So, but for her to, you know, in fundraising, for example, that's not going to happen tomorrow. But I do want her to be better than me. I want her to succeed better than me. And so my job right now is to help build the next stepping stones for her. And I think what that does is it helps to remove this them and us kind of posture and this fear, this, you know, feeling threatened and feeling, for a young person, I think they could feel like ignored, not understood, et cetera, right? And so I think that's kind of the coaching, that's the leadership style that would help with that situation. That's been my experience of it.
Yeah, I've got to go back and listen to, and I would encourage our listeners to do the same. I got to go back and listen to our earlier conversation, Liz, because I seem to recall some of the themes in your advice and your suggestions being very consistent. I'm trying to remember what we talked about, but I'm anxious to hear. Okay, so we've talked for a few minutes about these younger individuals, and we've talked about honoring this retiring / graduating generation. But I tend to feel like there's a group of people like myself and yourself. So I'm in my early 40s and you're in your early 50s. And I tend to feel like there's a group of us like us, between you and I, that are okay, that are better for the workplace where it finds itself right now, largely because of its sort of the messiness and the confusion and the complexity of what's there. And I don't know that the younger generation or the older generation, and I'm not trying to suggest that we're just Gen Xers who have inferiority complexes, but I almost think that's maybe what we've always had. Are we just this weird middle generation that's sort of insecure, but we're okay with the messiness of where the world finds itself right now?
Yeah, I don't know that I can, I'm not a sociologist, I guess, but yeah. I guess what I do, a little bit that I have kind of, you know, read on that stuff is that certainly the generation ahead of us, you know, it came out of a time of two world wars. It came out of a time of security, seeking security. You know, if you look at DACA as a leadership, you know, style, it was all about, you know, process. It was all about, you know, well, certainly strategy. I think we still have strategy, but definitely process. Technology wasn't moving as fast. So, you know, before you could plan for 10 years and a lot of things would be fairly set, you know, would be fairly similar in 10 years. Today, strategic planning is essentially anywhere between 1 year and 5 years at max because there's too many technological changes moving very, very fast that prevent us from kind of looking any further down the line. So I think, you know, it's kind of a joke that we have in the Catholic world is, you know, I don't know if anybody who's not Catholic will understand this, but as Catholics, we are very comfortable with ambiguity, meaning we're very comfortable with mystery. We don't need to know it all, you know? So, it's kind of a joke in the sense that I feel like that's it in leadership is that for me anyway, I'm quite comfortable with ambiguity because I've lived with so much change. And Now, I do get to a point where, so along with ambiguity, like in a work environment, communication is really, really important for me. And I think the generation ahead of us did not communicate well. And so if they're still in roles of leadership and they're facing ambiguity, they tend not to communicate with their team, and that creates even more problems, greater problems, right? So I don't know. I don't know whether, you know, that's unique to our generation or whether we've had to just adjust and learn. I think the last 10 years of my life have been, have had very dramatic, I've had learning curves in the last 10 years of my professional career. I've had more learning curves than perhaps I even had in the first 10 years of my career. I'm gonna throw that out there as a question, you know, and a pondering, simply because of technology.
Yeah, you're familiar with some of the ideas. Before I let you go, you're familiar with some of the ideas that I'm pushing out there with regards to these multiple lanes. And I tend to think that when we talk about fundraising in particular, so you and I have spent the first 15 or 20 minutes here talking primarily about in very general, broader terms. But when we come down to – so when we come down to sort of the messiness where fundraising finds itself today, and I think it's experiencing some of the messiness that I think fundraising is experiencing is a reflection of these shifting and movings of generations through it. But I also think that this gets to kind of your point there, which is where I'd like to hear more. I don't know that fundraising has gotten particularly comfortable with that ambiguity. And I don't, or that uncertainty. I think we've inherited a lot of what we would have expected to come from the Enlightenment and from the Industrial Revolution, where everything could sort of run like a machine and it was very predictable. Is it our generation that maybe can sort of, bring some of that to the table and make it actually valuable and useful and helpful? Or will fundraising ever let itself be mysterious and uncertain?
Yeah. So I think, you know, to your point, you know, the history of fundraising around methodology, right? The development of methodology.
Yes.
And then so we run a campaign, we do this, we send out mailers, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
System. To your view of moving it to a relationship, right?
Yeah.
Which I'm fully in accord with.
Yeah.
So I think whenever you get into relationship stuff, you know, I just ask anybody if they've ever been married, you know, it's messy, right? Or have you ever had kids? It's messy. Or are you part of a family? It's messy. So, you know, it has these messy elements. I think that where the tension, and I'm not sure if we've answered, you know, I feel like for me, I walk every day in my work where I wouldn't say it's a negative tension, it's just a tension that exists between strategy, planning, institutional priorities, objectives on one hand, and then on the other side of that is being focused on others, you know, being benefactor-centric. Being programmatic centric, you know, just being in my world, being responsive to the movements of the Holy Spirit that brings about opportunities that you don't even see when you walk in the door. You know, they just show up.
Yeah.
Being responsive to those.
Yeah.
So I think that's the tension that exists in business, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily, and certainly in the nonprofit world, I'm not sure that's necessarily going to go away. I think it's probably the new norm and has been for a while. And I find that exciting. For me as a spiritual person, I find it exciting because it means that while I might know some, and as a leader, I might know a few things, every day can be different. And it requires me to have a life of faith and really seeking out others, collaborate. It forces me into teams and collaborations that perhaps I wouldn't rely upon in the past. And I just find it very exciting and stimulating that, you know, I don't have all the answers and I don't have to have all the answers, which is great.
Well, that is a very refreshing place to end this series of 10 conversations, because I don't know that we landed on anything precise, but I can tell you that throughout this series of 10 conversations, we've had lots of opinions that I think were very valid and useful. But I really like where we ended here. Liz, if somebody's listening to us and they're interested in reaching out to you, they know how to find me. But if they're interested in finding you, how would you suggest that they do that?
They can email me at Franciscan University. So it's L Schreiner, spelled S-C-H-R-I-N-E-R at franciscan.edu, or they can reach out to you and you can pass on my phone number. How about that?
That'll be fine.
More than happy to chat with anybody.
Yes. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. God bless.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.